Matthew chapter 9. You may turn on the equipment now. I didn't want that to be public. Matthew chapter 9. We're going to talk about a situation here of Jesus has a couple of healings today, a couple situations where he's working in the crowd, working among people. And we're going to learn several things or identify several things. One thing we will notice is the way different people respond to Jesus and how he responds to them as he moves among the people. But first, I want to look in chapter 9 of Matthew, beginning in verse 14, and read into a couple of verses that I really didn't cover last time we spoke about this. Kind of, I think because Matthew's writing the book, I think some of these things are leading into each other. He's building on them. And we're going to cover just some information about where Jesus says you can't put new wine into old wineskins, indicating that there's a change coming. And I think, again, you always have to be thinking, because there's varieties of ways of looking at trying to figure out how this all comes together. The Bible is you want to say it's a simple book, it's God's revelation, but as we try to tie it together, you can, you know, weave it together in different ways and get different patterns. And so you need to be careful. I need to be careful. But so as we look at this, I think what he's talking about in these verses that we're going to read, and you can think about it, is that Judaism, or the Jewish religion, Israel, was one of the nations that God chose, or the nation that God chose, and he'd given them certain revelation. They were to go into the world. They were to be a blessing to the world, and there's things that were given to them, and which includes the law of Moses, the rituals, the temple worship. But Jesus was going to come, and he was going to come through Israel, but was going to come to the whole world. And his purpose, and I think this is accurate, but you keep thinking, Jesus' purpose was not to bring Judaism or temple worship to the whole world. It was to come through Israel and bring the good news. You can see this breaking down, or the separation coming in the book of Acts. In 48 AD, when they had the first church council, when the Jews were still thinking, the Jewish Christians were still thinking they needed to bring all the Gentiles into the Jewish faith, and then they could introduce them to the Messiah. And Paul and some of the other leaders had gotten outside of Judea, outside of the Israel faith, and they were up into Antioch, Syria, they're going up into Asia Minor. And what they began to do is actually just go directly to the Gentiles and teach them about the Messiah, kind of bypassing the whole Judaism concept of, oh, you got to go to the temple, you got to do these things, and just introduce them to the Messiah for the world. And that brought about some huge changes, and the Jerusalem Council of 48 AD kind of addressed those things. What do we do about circumcision? What do we do about the rituals? What do we do about the temple? What are the Gentiles going to do? And they came to the conclusion, clearly, Peter and Paul have both had success in their ministry of going directly to the Gentiles with the good news of Jesus Christ, and God responds, the Spirit comes, the church grows, people reach maturity, they're clearly saved. We don't need to go back into through the temple and all the Israeli or traditions or the rituals of Judea. Chapter 9, verse 14. I think that's what is being said here, but you listen to it. Verse 14. Then John's disciples came and asked him, how is it that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? Jesus being the bridegroom. The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them. Then they will fast. This is a time where they don't need to seek, because I'm talking to them. I'm right here in front of them. But the time is coming where they will need to seek me, because I will no longer be walking among them. Verse 19 or 16, he then says, no one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. So in other words, the idea there is you've got a garment, you know, I always think of like blue jeans or something, but that's not what he was thinking about. And you take that have been shrunk, they've been washed, you know, they're not going to change, they just keep wearing out, but there's a hole in them. And you take this unshrunk cloth and you sew it on there nice and tight. It looks a nice, like a nice patch, like we used to put them on when I was a kid on our knees and wear them again. You don't see that anymore. They come that way. But nonetheless, I got to get back on track. That had a whole bunch of conversations coming after that, but we got to go. But if you put a patch on that isn't shrunk, you'll sew it on there, and then the patch will shrink, then just tearing away and making the hole worse. Now you've got a half-sewn-on patch on your clothes, and it's hanging off. The tear is worse, and you've made the patch worse. So Jesus is saying here, neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. And the idea here, very quickly, a wineskin, when it was new, when it was freshly made, it would be flexible. But as it aged, it would get hard, and it would stiffen up. And if you put wine into an old wineskin, in fact, the old wineskins, they would use them for water jugs. You know, once they used them for wine for a while, And the wine, of course, it would ferment originally in the vat, but after it's done fermenting, they'd put it in the wineskin, but it would still ferment, meaning it would expand. There'd be an expansion, the release of gas. And if you got it tied into an old wineskin, it's the old brittle wineskin that's no longer flexible is going to just crack and it's all going to spill out. And you're going to ruin both the old wineskin, which could be used for a water jug. It doesn't leak. It just does. It's not flexible anymore. And you're going to spill out the wine. And so Jesus says right here, neither do men pour new wine. And I think he's talking about his message. He's talking about what Jesus is bringing to the world through Israel. New wine into old wineskins. And I think he's talking about the Jewish faith. You can't take this new revelation of where God is going and try and shove it back into the Old Testament, back into the laws of Moses, back into the religion of the Jews. It's come through the Jews, but you're going to have to let it go. And now we just read on. If they do, the skins will burst, and the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour. Now notice, it does mention the wineskins being ruined. Now again, here's just a point of doctrine that you're going to have to get more evidence before you build your doctrinal statement here. But notice right here, he is concerned about the wineskins being broken. There's two things could get ruined. He says the wineskin will be ruined and the wine will be lost. In other words, if the old wineskin is Judaism, he's not going to just throw it away. He's just saying the new wine in Judaism is going to mess up the message of that the Jews had, and it's going to mess up the wine where he's taking it to the world. But if you do it right, he goes on, no, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and notice, both are preserved. Both are preserved. And again, you do what you want to with this, but Israel isn't just thrown out on the trash heap of history. They are there. He doesn't want them ruined. They've got a place, I think, yet in eschatology, but that if you put them together, you're going to get both of them are going to mix up. You're going to mess up Israel, and you're going to mess up the church. The two are separate. But nonetheless, the idea here, Jesus talking to John the Baptist's disciples, telling them, you guys are fasting. You guys are bringing revival, reformation to Israel, waking Israel up, so they have a chance to respond to Jesus. Now, once they respond to Jesus, we're not going to take the reformation or the revival that Israel's experiencing and shove it back into the Mosaic Code. We're going to take that to something new. And now we begin a section right here, beginning in verse 6, 18, where Jesus has come across. If you look in chapter 9, verse 1, Jesus stepped into a boat, crossed over, and came to his own town. That's Capernaum. He's come back across Galilee, and now he's gone into a house on the shore of Galilee, and he's apparently sitting in the house. This story is recorded in Mark and Luke also. Matthew does the quickest, shortest presentation of the story. We may, if I get a chance, we'll run over and read it out of Mark also, and we'll get a little more detail to it. But what is going to happen here, Jesus is going to be brought, someone's going to approach him. Jairus is his name. He's the synagogue ruler. Matthew just calls him a ruler. It could be a political ruler. It could be an official business person. It could be a synagogue, a religious leader. Mark and Luke tell us that it is a synagogue ruler. Here we just know that he's a ruler. And he's going to approach Jesus. He's going to come into the house, apparently, where Jesus is at. Now, again, I'm trying to build the case. Well, no, I think Jesus walking along the shore. Well, go with that if that's how you think it happened. But it appears to me that Jesus has come across, he's gone into a house, he's sitting around a table with his disciples, and there's some kind of conversation. This religious leader, this Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, which you know where the synagogue is at, you can still see the synagogue, that was the case. Now remember, the synagogue ruler would have been the leader of the synagogue. He'd be like the head pastor, but he was more of the organizer of the whole thing. He didn't always speak. He was more of the organizer of the people. He'd give different people responsibilities to read the scriptures, to make bring the messages. He was kind of like the ruler of the synagogue, kind of like, if you want to call it, the CEO of the synagogue. Not necessarily the main speaker, but that doesn't mean he didn't speak. So anyway, he's got a very prominent place in the city. And notice, he comes to Jesus. Again, understanding this idea, there's something new happening in Israel. In accordance with the biblical prophecy, something new is happening. And I think about Jesus sitting in this house, people around, he's probably talking, and the synagogue ruler comes in and approaches Jesus. And he's going to ask him to do something. And Jesus is going to walk to this man's house. And on the way, crowds of people are going to be around him. And a woman is going to come up and touch him during this whole time to be healed. And Jesus is going to continue to move through the crowd. Now, in this situation, there are hundreds of people. And at any time, and it's going to break loose. Once people figure this out, it's going to break loose where crowds continue to come to Jesus and want something. And it really comes to the head in John chapter 6 when Jesus multiplies the bread and he can't shake the crowd because they don't want him. They don't want the new wine. They don't want the message of salvation. They don't want this revelation from God. They want bread and they want healing. They want, you know, like we've said before, they want government health care where everybody gets healed, and they want some kind of government funding for just a program that feeds everybody. This is great. And we just continue in our lives doing what we want. Jesus walks away from that crowd. He addresses that crowd. He confronts that crowd, and many of them leave him. Not because they leave their salvation or because they've lost their salvation per se, but they never came to Christ for the right reason. Once they start seeing Jesus healing and multiplying bread, they realize this is a great program. We all want in on it. And they never really understood the message. At this point in Jesus' ministry, his message is still going forth, and there are people understanding it, realizing they're connecting the dots, like in Jeremiah or Isaiah, where it talks about when this man comes, the lame will be healed, the blind will see, the dumb will hear or speak, the deaf will hear. It's going to be a great time. And when they make this connection that this is him, they separate from the crowd and they come to Jesus and they ask. And realize not everybody's making that connection because Jesus can still walk through crowds. They're amazed, but they don't have enough understanding. They just come to him and ask him for stuff. Eventually they will, and there are going to be people coming for all kinds of ridiculous reasons, and then Jesus will have to put a stop to say, you don't really understand what you're talking about. It reminds me of something that happened one time when I was with a group of seniors, high school seniors. We went to Chicago one time, and this is just an example. What would Jesus be like today? Like if he was on the earth today and people were seeking him, and he just came to Jesus and asked for anything, and he would give it to you. Because that's what it appears in this story. People are just coming to him when they ask. He stops what he's doing and goes and takes care of the situation. Now, I'm going to tell you today that Jesus does that. Jesus will respond to you. You come and you ask, you seek. Like he came to Solomon and says, ask me for something and I will do it for you. Jesus tells them in Matthew, ask, seek, knock. And I tell you today, one of the big problems that we have in Christianity as far as our individual faith is we stay at a distance. Instead of coming and saying, I want God involved in this part of my life. I want Jesus to intervene right here. We call it prayer. We call it seeking God. But instead of just living your life and saying, well, God's over there and I'm busy doing this thing, it's like bring him into your life. When someone came to Jesus, I want you involved in here, Jesus never said, no, I don't have time. I'm busy. I'm thinking about autograph seekers. I'm thinking about celebrities that are moving through our culture. And whenever they, you know, they got to have a security around them because if they get out of the car, they go shopping, everybody wants their autograph or wants, you know, to talk to them or interview them or something. And I'm thinking about a story with Harry Carey. You remember Harry Carey? Radio announcer for the Cubs, a great announcer for the Cubs for years. We took the seniors to Chicago, the high school seniors, and I don't want to drag this story out. It's not that important. But we were, there's a kid. His name's Matt. I'm still friends with him on Facebook. He's older now. He's got his own family. Still see him at the Iowa Cubs games once in a while. But and Matt's still a Cubs fan. But I remember Matt when he was in junior high, a little boy, lived across the street from me, and he was a Cubs fan. I mean, you know, picture a junior high boy, a Cubs fan. Cubs shirt, Cubs hat, Cubs pencils, everything was Cubs. And by now he's a senior, and I've known him for several years, and so now we're together. I got the class in Chicago, and we go to a Cubs game. And we sit in Wrigley Field there, we watch the Cubs play. After the game, we're out getting on our bus, getting on our charter bus to head back to the hotel, and sure enough, this big limousine-like car is sitting right by our bus. And there's people crowded around the back window. And I say, Matt, I think that could be Harry Carey. So me and Matt get off the bus, and we go stand by the, there's only two or three people there now when we get there. And Harry, he's an old man, I mean old man. And he's got a baseball and a pen, and he's writing. And it's like taking, I'm thinking, come on, Harry, hurry up. Matt wants your autograph. Matt's been wanting to see you face to face. This is a huge, this is like, you know, a big deal for Matt. For me, it's like, Harry Carey, you know, there you are, nice guy. But Harry's right. I don't know if he's writing like John 3:16 or maybe the whole chapter of John. I'm not sure. But he's writing forever on this ball, like in slow motion. And just taking time, and he hands it out of the window. And me and Matt are next. And Matt's right there, got the program and a pen, and he's trying to stick it in the window. And Harry goes, no more, no more, no more. kind of like that fast. And I go, Harry, you got to sign one more. Please, Harry. He says, this is your number. The window's going up. Harry, this is your number one fan. You got to sign it. And there's Matt standing with his program and a pen. It's like, Harry, just to scribble on it. Not just draw a line on it. And Harry drove off in his limousine. Now, nice story, whatever that means. Me and Matt talk about it on Facebook every once in a while still. But the idea there is that's what celebrities are like, you know, in the real world. I mean, Harry can't stand there and sign everybody's autograph for his autograph for everybody, you know, especially at his age. He was very, very old. And but Jesus is not like that. You're not going to get up to the limousine window and he's going to the window's, sorry, no more. And the window's going to go, wait, I got just one more healing, one more prayer request. No more. And I think about that as we go through. So here we go. Here's our story. And think about Harry Carey and think about Jesus, how, I guess you want a corny title here. If this was a mega church, I'd try and say it, you know, Jesus is no Harry Carey, or Harry Carey is a no Jesus, or something like that. And then we're not a mega church, so I won't give it a corny title. Chapter 9, verse 18. While he was saying this, so he's just talking about the wineskins, the new wine, a ruler came and knelt before him. This would be Jairus. And says, my daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her, and she will live. Now, this is synagogue ruler. This guy is steeped in Judaism. He follows the traditions. And right away, one, he comes into the house, apparently. He comes up to Jesus, my daughter has just died. This is now a personal issue. This is no longer about codes and rituals and regulations. This is about my family. And you, I know you're not a qualified, you know, rabbi, or what school you'd go to, we don't know. But I know you can fix this. And then he says something amazing, if you look at it. He says, come and put your hand on her. Whoa, wait a minute. Did you just say she's dead? That's right, she's dead. Would you come put your hand on her? Oh, no. Because to touch a dead body in Judaism would make me unclean. You know the rules. You're a synagogue ruler. We don't touch dead bodies. Far be it. I'm sorry. Can't help you. No more. But instead, he says, do this thing. He says, and she will live. Now, they've got 24 hours. In their culture, they had 24 hours to bury the body. And that's, you know, Jesus on the cross. They took him off the cross. They buried him the same day. And they came back after the Sabbath to kind of finish the burial procedures. Also, they would have these mourners. You're going to see the mourners coming. Everybody was required to have mourners. Even the Mishnah said, the Mishnah, that's their commentary of the Old Testament, said that when someone dies, the least you can have is two flute players and a woman wailing. Okay, so if you've got two flute players and a woman wailing, you've got mourners. And these were professionals. Kind of like if you hire somebody to sing at a funeral or something like that, the person's singing a very, very, you know, funeral type song. But it's not. They may not even necessarily know the person they're singing. They're just there to sing the song. And they try to sing with emotion and bring the crowd to a place of remembrance and things like this and minister to the people as they're singing. And then they leave and they go to the next funeral. You know, again, that's not saying anything bad about people who sing at funerals. And sometimes people do sing at people they know's funeral. But in this case, it's true. They would hire professional mourners. It was required. Even the poorest people would have professional mourners come. Again, the least you have is two flute players and a woman wailing. So you got do flute playing. Whoa, someone's crying. It's kind of like us singing at a funeral. That's what was take place. And they're going to take, that's going to be happening. So that the mourners have already shown up. Jairus leaves the house. The mourners have already shown up. And he's telling Jesus, quick, we're on a time schedule. The burial's going to take place. The mourners are there. But if you'll come touch her dead body, I know things will change. Here's a man. Now, again, where are they getting these precedents? How do they know this? After a few events here, further on in the Gospels, it's going to be clear. Jesus can do anything. I mean, he's touching the dead people and they're being raised. He's healing the lame. He's opening eyes. He's walking on water. He's multiplying bread. This man can do anything. And now people are going to be rushing to him for a variety of reasons, which have nothing to do with their faith or their understanding. Jairus, nonetheless, has come. He goes, I'll read it one more time. My daughter has just died. But come and put your hand on her, and she will live. Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Got up may indicate that they're sitting somewhere. I think maybe in a house. But they could be sitting around a campfire there on the beach. I don't know. Just then, so now they're moving through the streets to Jairus' house. The disciples are with Jesus. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up. 12 years, we can read in Mark and Luke, especially Mark, says that she'd gone to the doctors, and Mark gives a little more detail. She's gone to the doctors, she spent all of her money hoping that they could help her, but she's actually gotten worse. So she's everything they can do. And also it's going to say, as they're going through, there is a crowd following Jesus, which of course is typical, and their people are bumping up against him. Stay with me. Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. That's what the NIV says. Touched the end of his cloak. She had said to herself, back at home, previous in the day, she had said to herself, if I only touch his cloak, I will be healed. If I can only get to him and touch his cloak. Healed is the word sozo, S-O-Z-O, translate other places in the New Testament as saved. Healed, again, the word sozo means more than just healed physically or just saved spiritually. It means delivered. It can mean delivered from the military, delivered from poverty, delivered from whatever your problem is. That's what sozo, it means you're saved. Maybe delivered from a storm at sea. And she needs saved from her affliction. And so she says, if I can just touch his cloak. Now this touch the cloak, I'm going to show you something very, very quickly. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy 22. No. Numbers 15:38. Numbers 15:38. We'll skip the... Numbers 15:38. And here's where this comes from, the cloak. Actually, what it appears, and it's pretty clear that this is the case, is that they're talking about the tassels around the fringe of Jesus' cloak, his garment, the tassels. And the story is in the Old Testament, Numbers, and we're going to be jumping way back to Numbers here, around 1400 B.C., it's like 1400 years earlier. And what takes place in Numbers chapter 15, verses 32 through 36, there's a man went out on the Sabbath and began to pick up sticks. And he somehow either forgot about the law of Moses, he forgot about don't work on Saturday, the Sabbath, and ended up picking up some sticks. And, of course, he ends up getting stoned to death because of this. And so in verse 37, the Lord said to Moses, and it would appear that it may be in response to this tragedy. We had to stone this man because he broke the Ten Commandments. This may be part of the new wine and the old wineskins. We don't have to do this. We're in a new age, but that's another story. Verse 37, the Lord said to Moses, verse 37 of chapter 15 of Numbers. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, throughout the generations to come, you are to make tassels on the corners of your garments with a blue cord on each tassel. You will have these tassels to look at, and so you will remember the commands of the Lord. In other words, from now on, everybody's going to put little tassels on their cuffs. So when we walk in, it's like, why do we all got tassels on our cuffs? It's like, oh yeah, the Word of God. We can't forget the commandments. In other words, he says, there's no excuse for someone to forget because the tassels, why the tassels? Because the Word of God. And he goes on and talks about it, that you may obey them and not prostitute yourselves by going after the lust of your own hearts and eyes, and goes on and talks about that. Okay, we go back to Matthew. We're going to look in verse 14, chapter 14, verse 36. And what this woman did, and I'm not sure if this was the reason for it, but in chapter 14, verse 36, I'm going to begin reading in verse 34 of Matthew chapter 14, Matthew 14, verse 34. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized Jesus, they sent word to all the surrounding country. Notice they recognized Jesus had just landed on the shore. This is later on. People brought all their sick to him. In our story today, he's going to walk through the crowd to Jairus, and one woman is going to come out and touch him. Now when he lands on the shore, all the sick, he can't get up off the shore because all the sick are brought to him. Touch him, touch him, touch him. And begged him to let the sick just touch the edge of his cloak. And all who touched him were healed. So he's just walking and people are touching the cloak or touching those tassels on his garment. We can see this again if you don't mind looking at one more place. Go to Matthew 23, verse 5. Because any good thing is worth overdoing. Any sincere thing is worth being a hypocrite about. And indeed, it wasn't just Jesus who had tassels on his garment, but all the Pharisees, all the religious leaders, they did it. But of course, they didn't just have tassels. They had, you know, huge tassels. You may have little tassels, but look at mine. Mine are full color, and they're much bigger. I can hardly walk. My tassels are so big. Well, here we go, chapter 23,
verse 5. Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries, that's the little boxes on their foreheads. My gosh, I don't want to make fun of them. But the idea in the Old Testament is this word should always be on your mind. You know, you should know these things. And what they would do, they'd put little boxes, you know, strapped to their forehead, and they'd put little scriptures in those boxes and shut the door. Got it. It's like, do you have the Word of God on your mind? Yes, I do. Look. And they got it. It's like, they're the letter of the law. And you can go to the Western Wall, not to make fun, you go to the Western Wall, they still have them. They still have these things. But notice, not just the boxes, the phylacteries. Where am I at? Verse, okay. They make the phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogue. Okay, we go back to Matthew. So it appears that Jesus himself, and I know it says the edge of his garment, but I think it's pretty clear. It's the tassels from other ways of looking at this and doing more of a word study on this. He's got tassels on it, and she realized that right up here, if she could just come and touch the tassels on this man's garment, if I could just reach out and touch him, she would be healed. Now, if we read in the other accounts right here, let me just read down through this, and we'll look at it again. Verse 20. Just then, I'm in chapter 9, verse 20 of Matthew. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, touched those tassels. She said to herself, if I can only touch his cloak, I will be healed. So he's going to the crowd. Apparently, she's going to be behind. She reaches out, makes a touch on the garments, the edge of his garment, she's going to be healed. Watch. Jesus turned and saw her. Take heart, daughter, he said. Your faith has healed you. And the woman was healed from that moment. I do want to go to Mark chapter 5 and read this in Mark chapter 5, please. Same story. Matthew and Luke recorded also. Matthew has just reduced it. Some would say as they're studying the scriptures, trying to figure out why Matthew reduced it, that what he is doing, he's trying to make it a shorter story, more for memory's sake, more for something that they'd teach young believers so they could say it over, or new believers, so they could memorize these things and recount the story. So he leaves off some details kind of short. Some people would say that's the reason Matthew's doing it, using it for catechism purposes. Matthew chapter 5, chapter 5, let's begin in verse 24. Mark chapter 5, verse 24, same story. A little more detail. So Jesus went with him, Jairus. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. The key word there being pressed. So Jesus is not just walking through the street. There's a crowd pressing around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal at the care of the many doctors and had spent all she had. Again, you got to imagine medical practices 2,000 years ago in Judea. She had suffered much at the hands of the physicians trying to fix this problem. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. So Jesus working through the crowd, people are bumping. Now, this is important. This is one thing I'm going to try and point out. People are bumping into Jesus. They're pressing on him. It's not a matter that if you bump into Jesus, something's going to happen. It's a matter that this woman went out of her way, and many people are touching Jesus. In fact, the disciples. I'm in verse 30. At once Jesus realized, notice, that power, the word dunamin in the actual writing, but it means dunamis, means power, dynamite. We get our word dynamite from it. Had gone out from him. Jesus realized, people are bumping him. He's going through all of a sudden. Whoa! Something happened. Somebody touched me differently than everybody else. Everybody's bumping into him. But somebody touched him. Power had gone out. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? Now imagine being in the hallway at a basketball game at halftime trying to get popcorn. Whoa, who touched me? Who touched me? It's like, everybody's backing away. What? Everybody's touching you. It's like it's a crowd. And Jesus in this crowd does that very thing. He stops. Who touched me? And everybody backs up. And then watch. The disciples are trying to work through the situation. Damage control by the disciples. Verse 31. You see the people crowding against you? His disciples answered. And yet you can ask, who touched me? Jesus, look at all the people. What do you mean someone touched you? We're all getting touched. I mean,
it's going to be okay.
But Jesus kept looking around. He's not backing out. Looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear. A lot of reasons to be afraid. A lot of reasons. One, she's a woman touching a man in public. Okay, number one. Two, she is unclean with her medical condition. She has suffered 12 years, not just physically suffered, but she has suffered 12 years of being unclean. I mean, everything in her life is normal except for the fact of this medical situation. And she cannot move in public. Any place she sits is unclean. I mean, if she sits somewhere, it's like we can't come in here. I mean, she can shut down any public event by just walking in. It's like unclean. Everybody has to leave. It's like, so she's not, I mean, no friends, no parties, no invitations. She's just been alone for 12 years trying to solve this problem. And now she's gone out into a crowd, risking everything, not only touching a man, but now making everybody in the crowd unclean because someone's probably bumped into her. And then she goes out, and this is a celebrity. This is a celebrity. And she reaches out and touches this celebrity's clothes, making him unclean. This is not good. And so now all of a sudden, she just thought she could sneak up and I could just touch him, I'll get healed, and I'll blend back into the crowd and everything, just between me and God. Just between me and God, and I'll just blend back into the crowd. But she comes up, she touched him, he stops, someone touched me, and everything, I don't know. And she is trembling with fear as he turns around and finds her, where she came up and identified herself, told him the whole truth. He said to her, notice right here, we're in Mark chapter 5 now, he says to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Your faith has healed. Now, Jesus says, I've got it written down here. You can go in Luke chapter 18, Mark chapter 10. He says this to Bartimaeus, blind Bartimaeus. Says, your faith has healed you. Notice this, Luke 7, verse 50. He says it to the sinful woman. Your faith has healed. Your faith has made you well. And the Samaritan leper in 17:19. Indicating, again, the simple point is Jesus has got crowds of people. But it's Jairus who comes over to his house and says, my daughter died. I need you to come help me. And Jesus says, not now, not now. I'm busy, no more. Jesus gets up and goes on his way. Now, he's trying to get to Jairus' house. And, of course, Jairus is probably leading him. Come on, come on. Trying to get down to the house and working his way through the crowd. And all of a sudden, he loses Jesus. There's a crowd. It's like, oh, where's Jesus? And he's got to walk back and find him. And here's Jesus talking to this woman. It's like, oh, my daughter is dead. We're on a time schedule. The mourners are already there. And Jesus stopped everything and is talking to this woman and says, your faith has healed you. Because you understood, because you went out of your way, you came up and you did something radical. Both Jairus, now remember, Jesus is going to get nailed on the cross by the religious leaders. They are going to be behind that whole crucifixion, that whole persecution. Jairus breaks rank and comes to Jesus, my daughter's dead and you can fix this. That's radical for Jairus. The woman comes up being unclean, radically comes up and says, if I just touch him, it will change my life. So you've got all these people, but there's two of them in this story that recognize something and they do something radical. They go, in a sense, for the new wine. They understand something. They've got the faith. They've got the action. They do something that causes a huge change in their life. And this woman does that very thing right there. We could continue, but let's go back to Matthew 5 and see what else happens here with Jairus and his daughter. That's a great story. I mean, this woman, for so many reasons. She's unclean. Jewish tradition would say, you can't do this. But again, that's the old wineskin. This is some new wine, a new wineskin. She can. And remember, we've said this before. In the Old Testament, when the unclean touched the clean became unclean. Kind of a disappointing world to live in. Everything eventually is going to be unclean. But when Jesus comes, clearly all the way through this, we see the clean touching the unclean and the clean becoming clean, or the clean becoming holy, the clean becoming sanctified. Thus, we are all here. We are all saints. If we're believers in Jesus Christ, we are all saints. We were at one time sinners. We are at one time lost. We are at one time unclean. But because Jesus touched us, because the clean, because life touched death, we now have life. And it's not just in our lives. It is permeating through the world. It is permeating around throughout history, through the church. As the church continues to bring this truth to the world, we are making the unclean clean. We sanctify. We sanctify our places of work. We sanctify our government. We sanctify our communities, our families. Where we are, we bring sanctification or God's presence into those situations. Let's look at this again. Here we go. Verse 22, Jesus turned around and saw him in Matthew chapter 9 now, saw, take heart, daughter. He says, your faith has healed you. Now, obviously, that means what it means. It means he was the source of it all, but because she reached out and believed, she reached out and took action. She reached out with her decision, her will. She reached out and took it. It came to her. There are people bumping into him all the time. It's not just bumping into Jesus. It takes something from us reaching out and taking it, wanting it, responding. And the woman was healed from that moment. Verse 23, when Jesus entered the ruler's house, now we're back to Jairus and his daughter, when Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd. So it sounds like there maybe is more than just one woman wailing. These people maybe had a little extra money. They could bring in the backup singers too, or the backup wailers too. So you got the lead mourner going there, and then you've got the backup wailers. A couple of flutes are playing. Jesus walks in. Here's another conflict. Tradition is that, well, clearly the culture, this little girl is dead. The mourners are here. We've got 24 hours to get her buried. They're doing the professional mourning, and Jesus walks in. Jesus has never necessarily walked in on a situation like this. Or God, of course, you got stories of Elijah and Elisha raising the dead. But Jesus just walked into a cultural situation, and it's now the rules have just changed. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep. Go away. In other words, pick up your check and leave. We're done. We no longer have need of your services. Go away. He's not talking to family members. He's not talking about relatives that have traveled around the countryside to get to the funeral. He's talking about someone that they got a phone call or got a text message. We need you to come down here and mourn at this little girl's, into this little girl's house because she's just died. And Jesus comes in and says, okay, here, how much do they owe you? Here's your check. Thanks for coming. You're done. She's not dead. She's asleep. Okay, now what's he mean here? Is he saying they've misdiagnosed the situation? She's in a coma? She's not dead. Let me re-diagnose it. I think the girl's just in a coma. I don't think he's saying that. I think, and you can break this down in a variety of ways and study the word sleep and death in a variety of passages, but Jesus even, or Paul even used it, talking about the believers who have died are said to be asleep, and those who are unbelievers that die, they're considered dead. But Jesus, I think, is simply doing this. You keep thinking about this. If he just means sleep as another image for dead, then what he said is the girl's not dead, she's dead. It's like, what? She's not dead. No, she's not dead. She's dead. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. I think what he's talking about is two perspectives. In the natural man, she's dead, she's gone, it's hopeless, she's dead. But in my perspective, in my dimension, she's asleep. She's still here. She's still present. I'm just going to bring her back and wake her up. To the mourners, to the physicians, to the synagogue ruler, to the religion of the Jews, she's dead. You can't do it. She's gone. But to the new wine, to my position, she's not dead, she's asleep. Watch, I'll wake her up. You can't do it, but from my position, it's just like waking her up. So in other words, I don't think he's saying a different word for dead, he's talking about a different perspective. Nonetheless, they don't understand his perspective or what he's saying. Go away, the girl is not dead. You're free to go, we don't need your services any longer because from your perspective, she's dead, but from my perspective, I'm just going to wake her up because I can bring her back. But they laughed at him. Okay, well, what do you expect? I mean, oh, well, thank you. This happens often. Some of these people come in, they raise the dead. They're laughing. It's like, no way. Plus, they're losing their job. Maybe they get paid by the hour. We got a couple more hours. We want to sit here and, you know, play flutes and mourn. But they laughed at him. But notice verse 25, after the crowd had been put outside, it says it in Mark and Luke also, put outside. Put outside. When you put the dog out, that doesn't mean the dog ran outside. That means you put the dog outside. You ever put a dog out? I used to put kids out. Get outside. It's, you know, it's cold out. You've been in the house too long. Get outside and get out of the house. We put them outside. Put them out. That means open the door, push the dog out. In this case, he put them outside again. Maybe over talking this, but it doesn't look like they says, okay, thanks. Call us if you have any need of us and we'll come back again. It's like they're laughing. No, this is our job. We're here. She's dead. He's saying, no, you're relieved of your responsibilities. I'm here. I'm going to wake her up. No, this is our job. We are hired first. Jesus puts them out. I'm not going to say he picked them up and pushed them out or have some kind of a fight scene, although it'd make a great movie. But he put them outside by some kind of force. If it's just verbal force, But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. Just like waking a child up. Wakes her up by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all the region. In other gospels, they say that she got up and walked around. So she's up and she's walking around, just like a little child waking up and starts walking around the room, looking for something to eat or drink or, you know, just going on her life. She just woke up. And, of course, it says right here, the news of this spread through all the region. Go with me quickly, go back to Mark chapter 5, just to make a point right here of what Jesus is doing. I'll begin in verse, we're going to read this one more time, then we're going to wrap it up. I'll begin in verse 39 of chapter 5. Let's begin in verse 37. 37 of chapter 5 of Mark. And they're going to find out here that James, John, and Peter are brought in with him. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. As they got to the house, because one of the leaders, Jairus' servants, they come out and says, it's too late, she's dead, there's nothing we can do. And Jesus tells them, do not be afraid, did I not tell you? And he continues on. And from that point on, he stops the crowd, just takes Peter, James, and John. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him. After he had put them out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples, Peter, James, and John, who were with him, and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said, Talitha kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them, to give her something to eat. So right here, I just want to point this out. Gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this. Why? Again, there's a variety of ways of trying to figure this out. One, if he does, the crowds are going to become ridiculous. And they do. By John chapter 6, the crowds are ridiculous. The sincere faith is very, very limited. They just want healing. They want someone to touch them. They want to be better. They want their lives to be better. They want food. And it's like there's not even any connection to God. They're just like, give us something. And, of course, that's not his purpose. Another reason why, I believe, is that Jesus is going to reveal himself clearly, identify himself on Palm Sunday. He is going to make himself known, I am the one. But it's going to come after about a three-year period of moving amongst the people, teaching and instructing them, doing signs to prove that he is who he is. And then on Palm Sunday, it's now decision time, here I am. And, of course, there's going to be this procession, and then there's going to be the rejection, and he's going to end up on the cross once he reveals himself. So this time, I think he's still wanting to introduce himself. One, instead of having the big celebrity status, he wants to continue to work his way through introducing himself and giving people the chance to, like they did, they would evaluate the sacrificial lamb. They said they'd watch it for a period of time before they brought it in for the sacrifice so that it was pure and without blemish. This is Jesus' time of observation. Watch me and see these things. And he didn't want this crazy crowd. Anyway, that's something there to consider. As we continue in Matthew, if you look in chapter 9, verse 27, it goes on, and now Jesus is going to heal the blind and the mute. He's going to have another miracle before he sends his disciples out. This is now a talk about the new wine, not in the old wineskin, something new. He's going to go through a series of miracles, healings, fulfilling prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah and other places. And then he's going to bring his disciples together and send them out with the same commission. You're going to preach and you're going to heal, you're going to raise the dead, cast out demons, and he's going to send them out. And that's going to be, they're going to have seen him do many of these things. The thing I want to mention today as we close is this right here. Well, I mean, you got so many things happening in a story like this. One, Jesus is verifying his deity, verifying that he's the Messiah. You've got the message coming to Israel, it's going to go to the world. But here individually, personally, you've got Jesus moving among a crowd. You've got Jesus moving into the old wineskins of the traditions. This is how we do things. We mourn and wail and bury him. It's like, no, I raise him from the dead. He's responding, I want you to notice, he's responding not to everybody, because many people were bumping him and touching him, but he's responding to this thing called faith. And faith, what is faith? Faith is this, how do you demonstrate? It's you reach out, you ask, you respond. The way you act, what you do reflects your faith. The woman made a plan. She'd said to herself, if I go and touch him. And so she acted. She went and she did it. How do you know she's got faith? I know she, how did Jesus say, your faith has healed you? Where was her faith? The very fact that she's there reaching and touching indicates she's got the faith. Faith is more than just this abstract thought, I believe, I believe, I believe. If you believe, you'll be in the streets reaching, trying to touch him or wherever. If you're Jairus, I believe, sitting at home, I believe. No, Jairus went through the city of Capernaum, found Jesus, knocked on the door, came in, please, you got to come now. How do you know Jairus has got faith? Because he's here asking. And the same thing in our own lives. Do we have faith? Well, I've got faith. Well, if you've got faith, you can evaluate your own self. Are you reaching out? Are you knocking on the door? Are you coming into the house saying, you've got to come now, we need you now? If you are, that's going to be reflected in your life. How you live, the decisions you make will indicate your faith. And believe me, like we said, this brilliant megachurch message, Jesus is not Harry Carey. No more, no more, no more. It's like he's not going to put the window up on you and drive away. If you come, Jairus, he followed. The woman, he stopped and talked to her. He is going to respond to you. I don't want to say I guarantee that, but that's God's nature. You ask, he's going to respond. He's not going to put the window up and drive away because he's a celebrity and has just had a very, very busy day. He will respond if you reach out. Father, we do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word. We thank you for having a God who knows us, who sees us, who we can talk to, who we can respond to, and who will respond to us. We do ask that we may walk in our lives, that we would live our lives in a way that is pleasing to you, but also in a way that has faith, knowing that you see us, you work in our lives, that you are, again, part of what we're doing. We ask that we would grow in our faith, that we'd have confidence, that we'd see and continue to see you move in our lives, in our church, in our communities. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.